Our main speaker tonight is Clancy.
My name is Clancy Immersland, and I'm an alcoholic. I was a little touched when the basket came down to us. It was still empty when it got to me, so I guess there's not a lot of gratitude in the front row. I'm not judging, I'm merely reporting. But I'm glad to be here tonight for your 22nd anniversary. I remember when you started, and I might be the only one who's been here outside of Peggy for every 22 of the anniversaries. And I missed one, I think, because I had having some surgery. But I raised in my bed and had a moment of silence in your honor. If you believe that, you believe anything. But I've been around here a long time. Our group in Los Angeles, upon which this is based, kind of, is 54 years sober. Or 54 years in existence, and we have still a couple people that were there for the first meeting, so it really is kind of remarkable. It's not easy getting old in AA. I was thinking about that when I was sitting, looking around, and meeting a lot of people. It's very difficult when you're getting old. Period. In 1963, I was sober 5 years. And I came to New York on a project for a company I was working for, and I had a free day. So I thought, I'll go over to AA service office on 44th Street and meet Bill Wilson. So I went over there. I said, I'd like to see Bill Wilson. She said, well, he's booked up all day and all week and for 2 weeks in advance. I can get you in 3 weeks if you want to come back. I said, no, that's all right, never mind. So I came back. I went to the archives and looked through old pictures and clippings, and here comes Bill Wilson. He says, you're the boy who wanted to talk to me? I said, yes, sir. He said, well, my 11 o'clock didn't show up. Come on in. So we talked for an hour. And you know what he told me? I don't remember. I was more concerned with what he thought about me than what he was saying. Well, not my fault. And, you know, it makes it a little difficult. One thing about getting old in AA, I have to sidle up to new girls at the meeting, the pretty young girls, and say things like, hi there, does your grandma put out? And it's not easy. And you go to the meetings and say, do I come here often? I don't know if I come here often or not. But Alcoholics Anonymous has been a great boon to me. I grew up in Wisconsin. I ran away to sea when I was 15. Did not drink. I was raised in a very religious home, known as the little minister sailing around the Pacific in the war. But after the war, I went to the University of Wisconsin. I ran with the veterans and drank a lot. By the time I got out of college, I was a strong drinker. I'd been hired to teach journalism in a high school. I was chief justice of the student court. I was editor of the campus newspaper. And I was expelled right after graduation. If you can imagine, I got a blank diploma and a graduation and expulsion. But drinking, it turned out to be one of the greatest things I ever found. I remember telling people in bars, I don't know how to explain this to you, but alcohol is the best friend I've ever had. Friends come and go. Jobs come and go. Lovers come and go. Cities come and go. But when a few drinks is just redressing all the imbalances of that day, oh, it's great. It was just such a great thing. But over the years, I got a reputation among many people, including my wife and others, that I was an alcoholic. But I always knew I wasn't, for one very simple reason. Because alcohol is not something that obsesses me. My problems are much different. I remember spending hours thinking, what the hell's wrong with me? Why do I get in these jams, these problems? And it came clear to me that my problem is that I'm too sensitive to things. I feel things too intensely. I can see when I'm being rejected, but no one else can see it. I can see when I'm being screwed on the job. I can see when people are mean to me. And it makes a bad feeling in me. And I've done a lot of things. I spent a lot of money in psychoanalysis, but I've discovered when I was a young man that a few drinks just makes it right. And by 11 o'clock at night, you're able to drift over to the bar and say things like, "You with anyone, Granny?" Here I am. And but I got started getting in trouble. I got in problems and situations. And I was a pretty good writer, and I had some jobs. I worked as a sports writer as a young man when I got to college, as a sports writer in the Midwest. And then I married a girl who turned out to be a Catholic girl, much to my surprise. And she began turning out children at a remarkable rate. So I had to get a better job, and I got into advertising agencies and advertising jobs, and did them quite well for many years. But I had one pattern. I first went into work for a big manufacturing company in Beloit, Wisconsin, and I was supposed to write encouraging things and wonderful things about diesel engines. Not really something you can grab a hold of there, but where you been? Go out to see how your reading went over? Anyway, love is the answer. The question is, how do you get the clap? But I went to work at this place, and after I wrote some good stuff for them. I remember after a few months, they called me in and said, "Clancy, you really are a good writer." I said, "Thank you." They said, "But we really need you here Mondays, too. And on Tuesday morning, when you come in, you smell bad. And it's not good for the company." And I remember something I'd heard in college. And I tried. And I said, "You're right, Mr. Carlson. I guess I got drinking overseas. I was just a boy, and the horror I saw, it just stayed with me. I know I have this thing downtown called Alcoholics Anonymous. I'll go down there and get healed in a couple of weeks, and I'll be back." He said, "Good idea." He sent me off with, said, "We'll keep your pay coming." And because nobody knew anything about AA at that time, just a old place where old drunks went and never came back. And I was in there, went to my first AA meeting, eight fat guys sitting around a table, burping and competing on who drank the most and who lost the most. And it really was the dreariest view I could think. And I went to two or three of those things. I thought, this can't help me. I'm cursed with intelligence. And so I realized that I'd have to get a job somewhere else. So I left that job and went to an advertising agency in a nearby city where they hired me on the basis of my samples. And I worked there for about 5 months till one day they called me and said, "Clancy, you write very well." And I know. But then I tried it on them. Let me go to AA. And I did that for 10 years, in and out of AA all over the country. And I had these samples. Everybody liked me a great deal until I started missing work and coming to work drunk and things like that. And I didn't like to be that way either. But my big problem was this, and I'm sure some of the people here have had it. I don't intend to drink that much. When I get feeling good, theoretically, I should stop and then feel good. But instead, I keep going. I don't know how many times I've stopped after work for two drinks at 5:30 or 6 and looked up at the clock 2 minutes later and it's 11 o'clock at night. How can that be? How can that be? There's got to be some way that I can control and enjoy my drinking. I had no idea there was no control and enjoy. You either enjoy it or you control it. You don't do one or the other. And I finally kept going. I wound up in Dallas at the largest advertising agency in the South. And I was writing the ads, if you remember the old ads about Elsie and Elmer and the cow. And I was doing a good job, and they called me in one day and said, "Clancy, you're really a good writer." "Oh, yes, yes, but what else?" They said, "But last week, while you were apparently drunk, you insulted the head of the Fritos Corporation, and he almost canceled our billing right there, $8 million. And we can't have that. And you're a bad influence on our agency. You're discharged. We called your wife yesterday and told her we're going to do it, so she'll be waiting for you. I want you to clean out your desk. Here's a severance check. And I'm going to try to make it my business to see that you never write in advertising again. Now, that seemed to be an overreaction, but I didn't want to say anything. I didn't go right home, you know. It's bad enough to go home when they don't know. When they do know and they're waiting for you and their teeth are sharpened. I just stayed downtown Dallas and made some new friends and drank up my severance check. I had done that once before in Rockford, Illinois. I had done that. I came home and my wife said, "Where's the money?" I said, I bought something for the house, honey. She said, "What?" I said, "Three rounds." And she thought that was cute, but she wouldn't this time, I knew. So I got home and my clothes were all on the porch. Nobody in the house, furniture gone, she was gone, and just a note on top saying, "We can't take any more, we have to leave." So she and my children left, and I knew I had to get out of Texas because I was kind of through a series of bad breaks and misunderstandings on parole from the state hospital. And so I, about a week before that, a guy said to me, "You know anybody that'll drive a car to Los Angeles?" I said, "No, I don't know anybody that'll drive a car." But that morning I did. I called him up and said, "I know somebody who'll do it. I will." He said, "I thought you were a big shot of Tracy Locke." I said, "I was, but they turned out to be phony, so I quit." So he gave me a car and a credit card, and away I went. First day I got as far as El Paso, and where I used to be on the faculty of the university there until they found out I didn't have a degree. But I knew the town quite well, and I found a place to hide my car where it'd be safe. And I went to Juarez, where I like to believe I'm a living legend. And by midnight, I was standing in the bar of the Chinese Palace one more time. "Yo soy el maestro de los locos en Chihuahua." Ah, ha, ha, ha. And my fans all going, "Cabrón, cabrón." I think that means welcome in Spanish. And the next day, I had to get up. Got as far as Phoenix, where I didn't know anybody. And I had to hide my car some safe place. Had all my clothes and my money and my ID. And I found a really good place. Because I know it's a good place. I never found the car again. So it's still there as far as I know. And about as dusk came over, I was looking for my car. I was drunk. And the guy came down the street. I said, "Can you help me find my car?" He said, "Don't bother me." I said, "Come on, for Christ's sake, help me find my car." He said, "Don't bother me." And I grabbed him by the lapels, bad habit. And he took his pocket, took his badge, said, "You're under arrest, boy." And he threw me in the Phoenix jail. I don't know if you've ever been to the Phoenix jail, but they always said they're going to cool you off in there. But you don't really cool off when it's 132 in the jail. And I hated it. I remember the first night I was there, I have a great memory of the first night I was there. Just a little red brick nut house out in the prairie, and just got to sleep, and all of a sudden from somewhere, what the hell's that? But you get used to it after a while. And I got to sleep finally one night, and I was so sick, I got up in the middle of the night and had to throw up, I'll tell you, if you're kind of new, if you're going to throw up with the tile floor, because it's so nice. You can put your cheek on it. Oh, God, it feels good. I went to sleep, but this guy came back whose bed I threw up on, apparently. He was a nasty thing. He starts kicking at me. He said, "You jumped the son of a bitch, you threw up my bunk." And I don't think he meant to do it, but he kicked my front teeth out, which made it a little more resentful for me. But I finally got out of that nut house. And I went to California. I don't know why I went to California. I had nothing there to go for. It's just that memory of that car, I guess. And I got to Los Angeles, and I didn't know anybody there. I knew one guy there. He was a big shot in television. And I'd given him his start. He said, "If you ever need anything, kid, you come and see me." I thought, here's the time. So I called him up, and he showed me how to get out to Hollywood on his bus, and I went into his office. He looked at me and said, "Oh, my God, look at you." had blood on me and vomit and stuff. And he said, it's so terrible. He said, he gave me a couple $100s. He said, let me know when you need more. I said, gee, thanks, Ted. And I went downstairs and got a room and cleaned up a little bit and made some new friends. And a couple days later, I ran out of money. And I called up Ted. I said, Ted, my check hasn't come from Dallas for that car accident. I said, could you help me? He said, oh, yeah. He said, I called Dallas after you were in my office. You look so terrible. He said, they said you used to be a nice guy, but now you're a bum. And I don't want you hanging around my station. I said, oh, for Christ's sake, Ted, for old time's sake, please. He said, okay, tonight at 9 o'clock, I'll come out on our fire escape in the back of the alleyway. I will not have you come in the front again. And if you stand out there, maybe I'll give you something. I was out there at 8:30, raining on me at night. And he came out and said, Clancy, you make me sick. He threw a $5 bill and tousled down on the mud puddle. I crawled out and got that. That boy, I really fooled him. And the next night, I was sleeping in an all-night theater. I don't know if you know what they are. You don't have them in this part of town, I don't think. But on Skid Rows, usually, they have all-night theaters. They're primarily designed for street bums to sleep in. The tickets cost about 25 or 30 cents. And you get in there, and you go in there and sleep. But they really, it turns out, they don't stay sober. They don't stay open all night, as I thought they did. Guy came in at 5 o'clock and said, okay, you bums, everybody out! And you guy came in with a hose and started hosing down. And you stagger out in the rain. And the guy said to me, you want to sell a pint of blood, kid? I said, Jesus, do I ever. And we went about 8 blocks up to a blood bank. And we went and sat down, took a drop of blood of our ear. And pretty soon the guy came back and said, who's having a son? I said, I am. He said, you don't have enough iron in your blood to sell blood here. Sorry, kid. I said, oh, my God, I'm so sick. You got to help me. He said, I can't help you. Can't take your blood. Down here about 4 blocks is something called the Midnight Mission. It's a skid row place for bums like you. And go down there and maybe get some breakfast. So I went down there in the rain. And I went and I said, I'll come breakfast, please. He said, we just got done serving, kid. We're all done. I said, come on, for God's sake, give me a cup of coffee or something. He said, we're done serving. And I grabbed his lapel. Bad attitude, bad move. 2 guys threw over, 1 took each hand, and they threw me out the front door and said, and don't come back, you phony son of a bitch. I tried to explain, I'm not a phony. 3 years ago, I was on the faculty of the University of Texas. Ads that I wrote were running that very weekend in Life and Time and New Yorker, Collier's. I've had my picture in the New York Times for one of my achievements. But it's really hard to explain these things in midair. And I started out of that old mission in the rain, and I really had a feeling I was dying. I don't know what to do. I have no answer to my life. If some old guy had come up to me that morning and said, you know, Slim, you're dying. You're down to 120-some pounds. You've lost your wife and children. You'll never see them again. You've lost your career. One time they called you a boy genius. Look at you now. He said, your little mother up in Wisconsin is no longer allowed to accept phone calls from you because your stepfather is so tired of watching you play on her emotions. So she'll go down to her tiny bank account and take a couple dollars and send it to her little boy. Hope that'll help him. Now, you've been hanging around. You've been going to AA all over the country for the last 10 years for 2 or 3 days till you get sick of it and you find a way to beat the draft. He said, now you're dying. Why don't you go back to AA one more time and admit you're an alcoholic? And try to do something about it. And if someone had said that to me, they didn't, I would have had the answer. Because I am not really an alcoholic. I know what alcoholics are. They start drinking, they can't stop. I've stopped drinking many, many times. When the heat got bad enough, I can stop drinking. The problem is, after I stop, in a day or 2 or 3, someone seems to creep into my bedroom in the middle of the night and put an invisible spring in my gut. And the next day, somebody tightens that spring. And it doesn't come out as, I need a drink. It just comes out as, I'm sick of this crap. Sick of this crap. And I could take it as long as I can. At one time in Texas, I spent almost $10,000 in psychoanalysis to beat that. And I couldn't beat it. I took their pills, read their book, went to their meetings. But I'll tell you how you beat that. You have a couple drinks. Oh, God. And that really helped me. That's, I always, but I can stop drinking. I'm not drinking because I'm drinking. I'm not drinking because I love drinking. I love drinking because I'm able to see how crappy everything is when I'm sober. That's not a drinking problem. That's some sort of incisive problem dealing with people. And but nobody came up and talked to me that morning. I said to some guy, is there an AA club around? In case you want to be a long-term slipper, that's something you always add to your collection. Find there's one, when you're down and out and smell bad and look bad and nobody wants anything to do with you, there's one place you're always welcome, an AA club. It's the only place in the world where the worse you look, the better they like it. This one's mine, Jim. So I found where an AA club was. There's nothing down here. There's one in Wilshire and Fairfax. I said, where the hell's that? So when you just go up this hill street, cut left to Wilshire, walk west to come to Fairfax. And I did that. Doesn't seem bad. Turned out to be 7.5 miles in the rain. God. And I got to that club, and I almost didn't go in. I was so angry. And I would have gone in, except there was some guy in the doorway saying, welcome home, son. I thought, oh, shit. But I went in, and that turned out to be my sobriety date, although I didn't intend for it to be. You know, when they read the traditions tonight, there's a tradition in there that says the only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. I never had a desire to stop drinking. That's my only sanity saving. And you're going to turn your life over to God, no chance of that ever. But I stayed sober. The minute the manager of the club said, you look like you're terrible. I'm afraid you're going to die in our parking lot. You can come in here during the week. But three rules, no asking for money, which you've already done. No, none of your sarcastic remarks, which you've already think are so cute. And you have to go to a meeting every night in this hall. I thought, oh, God, that's almost worse than death. But I did, and I went to the meetings. They brought in big platters of chocolate cake, and I ate that and filled up on chocolate cake. And in those meetings, I saw a guy that I'd seen in the movies. I said, a movie actor? What do you know about movie actors? You know, they got a lot of money. I thought, I bet he'd like to have a new friend. So I became friendly, and he didn't want my friendship. And by Friday, I knew I was going to die. I couldn't eat any more chocolate cake, and I was sick of everybody and sick of everything. And I thought, I may have to sell out my last gasp of sincerity. So I went to this Bob. I said, Bob, I really admire your program. Would you be my sponsor and help me? He said, I sure will, kid, but I want you to do what I tell you. I said, oh, sure I will, Bob. But he turned out, I found out a couple days later, he wasn't a movie star at all. He'd been in three movies, little cameos, and I'd seen two of them, I guess, so I thought he was a movie star. I've been in more movies than he ever saw, but I didn't know that at the time. And so I thought I'd get some money from him. I didn't. I got nothing but harsh abuse. He was a graduate of the School of Hard-Hearted Sponsors. And the only thing they have to show for it is there's a lot of sober people. But what he would do, for example, he did a lot of speaking around. He'd call the club and say, have the kid on the corner at 6:30. I'll pick him up. So I'd stagger out there at 6:30, and he'd come up in his big Lincoln. Hop in. I'd hop in. We'd go to some, take me to some restaurant. He'd buy me soup or scrambled eggs, something I could chew. Then you'd go to the meeting, and I heard him talk. I heard him talk. It seemed like a million times. It couldn't have been, but I got so I could just... And then he'd lecture me all the way back to the mission afterwards, give me lectures on Christian living. I thought, I can't stand this anymore. I can't stand it. How can I break him up with this habit? I thought, If I ask him questions, maybe, he's so egotistical, he'll go on and on with the answers. And maybe he'll break up this hideous pattern. So on the way home from the Brentwood meeting one night, I said, Bob, I really admire your perspicacity and your intelligence, but there's one thing I don't know. Why is it I hear these people talk all the time about how much they drank and how much it cost them, and why don't they just, if it's all that bad for them, why don't they just stop drinking and forget about it? Seems a reasonable question. He said, kid, you apparently never learned much in your years about AA. He said, stopping drinking doesn't help. I said, what? They want me to stop drinking all the time. He said, stopping drinking doesn't help. Everybody in AA can stop drinking. And we all have, again and again. If you could stop drinking and it helped, there would be no need for AA. We'd all go home and be all right. He said, the curse of the illness that we have here is that a lot of people think it's alcohol, but it isn't alcohol. It's something that sounds like alcohol, and it fools a lot of people, but it's not alcohol. What could it be, Bob? He said, something called alcoholism. I said, oh, for Christ's sake, that's the same thing, Bob. He said, no, it isn't. An alcohol problem is overcome by stopping drinking. In this disease of alcoholism, you'll discover, which you probably already have, that stopping drinking makes it worse. Eventually, life becomes untenable, and you must have that couple drinks to get back in some possession of yourself. He said, the curse of alcoholism is not that you can't stop drinking, but you can't stay stopped. And that's why so many people die from it. And they die quitting drinking and quitting drinking and quitting drinking and going to churches and going to psychiatrists and going to all sorts of people. They do almost everything, but they won't sink to go into AA. I said, Jesus, Bob, I never thought of it that way. I've quit a lot of times, and it's almost as though my perception gets better when I stop drinking. I can see what crapheads people are. He said, that's the exact good description, he said, kid. That's your description. You seem to have all the symptoms. I thought, God, I have the symptoms. I said, Bob, what do you think my problem is? What can I do? I'm sick of being like this. He said, kid, I know a lot of people like you. And you know what they call themselves? They're alcoholics. I said, how could I be an alcoholic when my number one problem is not alcohol? He said, alcoholics are not people whose number one problem is alcohol at all. Alcoholics are people whose number one answer is alcohol. If it's your answer, you're screwed for the rest of your natural life. I thought, God, I never thought of that. It is my answer, but I have a lot of good reasons for it, but none of the reasons seem to mean anything. And I kind of took on a semblance that day. Maybe I'm an alcoholic. What if I am? I'll just do what he says for a little while till I get out of here, and then I'll forget about it, but maybe I am. So I did what he said, and I tried to be decent. And I think one of the great critical spots in my life came when I was about 4 months sober. I had forgotten all about it. I was telling a newcomer about it a couple weeks ago, and I thought, God, I'd forgotten all about that. When I was about 4 months sober, there was a woman in AA at that time named Happy Austin. And, oh, I hated her. I wanted to kill her, rotten bitch. Kept telling new girls to stay away from me. It just made me crazy. Hard enough as it is without front teeth. And I came in the meeting one night, there's my sponsor standing there, there's Happy, holding court with her stooges. She says, Clancy, I want to talk to you. I want you to go over to Happy Austin and apologize right now. I said, apologize? For what? Last night at the Frank Randall meeting, you called her a bitch. I said, Bob, she is a bitch. She said, why do you think so? She keeps bad-mouthing you with the new girls. She said, well, she's right. You go and apologize. And right there it all ended. I've had enough of this AA playing house. to go over and apologize to some bag that I just hate because Bob thinks it's a good idea. Nobody in the world. Rooms are full of people, half goofy, all of them, and I should do that. And I decided I'm going to leave AA. I've given it 4 months. That's as long as I could ever go to make it. And I was just about out, but unfortunately for me, or fortunately, my feet stayed honest. Sorry I called you a bitch. You bitch. But I thought about that later. That was the first time in my conscious life, in my adult life, I'd ever done something that I absolutely refused to do, where I surrendered a part of my selfishness. And that really helped me. And everything was wine after that. I'm on my first step now. He explained to me the second step, about the second step. I said, I can't do the steps, Bob. He said, why not? I said, I hate God, and God hates me. He said, how do you know that? And I told him, in the mid-1950s, I went through a spell where I would get to a right level of drinking. I'd go out in the street and counsel police officers, which is a stupid occupation, I'll tell you. You're a fascist pig, you know that? And I got arrested several times overnight, get out in the morning, have time to go home and clean up, and go to work. I came out one morning, and my neighbor was standing there. I said, what the hell are you doing here? He said, well, I heard you were down here. I came down to give you a ride home. I said, you should have done that. I got that bastard's badge number. I'm going to make his life just untenable from now on. He said, I don't know about that. He said, but while you're out drunk, we couldn't find you, and your little son died. And, oh, God, that just killed me. I had a bunch of little girls and one little boy, and that just about killed me. We took his little body up to northern Wisconsin and buried him next to his grandmother. And where a couple years ago I buried his mother. And I put my hand in his little casket. I said, John Emmisland, this will never happen again. I swear to God, this will never happen again. I'm so sorry. I love you, and I'm so sorry. And I went back to Texas, and I quit drinking. I didn't go to AA because AA makes me want to drink. I quit drinking. I start to come home at night after work, have dinner with my kids, first time in a long time, help them with their schoolwork, sometimes go for a ride, joke at the table. Every meal we said a little prayer for baby John. And we really had probably the best 2 or 3 weeks of our life. And one night, of course, what had to happen, somebody snuck into my bedroom, put an invisible thing in my gut again. And the next day I was a little tense. And I said, I know what this is. I can do this for baby John. It's just crap, I'll just get through this. And next day it was a little bit worse. And the next day I got up, I was just tense as I could be. Didn't want to go to work. Next morning I didn't want to even get up. I can't stand any more of this. But if I just get a cup of coffee, maybe that'll do it. And I went out to the kitchen quick. There was no coffee. Little note there. I've taken the girls to church. Well, screw that. I bring home all the money. I can't get a damn cup of coffee. And I went out to the garage, took a hose and introduced it from the exhaust pipe into the inside the car. I'll tell you why you would do that. Because if you just go in the garage to kill yourself, the motor will die from lack of oxygen. So you have to get the exhaust not going. You have to have the air clear for them. God, it's a sickening procedure. But I died. And my neighbor next door was watching out of his breakfast nook window or something. And he saw me go in there with my motor running. He ambled over there to find me. He found me dead in the car. And he put me out and they beat on my chest. And they called the emergency and rushed me to the hospital and examined me and determined I was seriously ill. And then after they got me physically well, they looked at my emotions and determined I was not prepared to meet reality. That's how I got committed to the Texas Nut House. That's how I happened to go there. It was not because of anything bad habits, just bad breaks. And But that's how I get to it. I stopped drinking. That's not a drinking problem. And I knew that I could not return to the steps because when my little boy died, I remember just shrieking, God, screw you, God! You can take my little boy that never committed a sin in his life and killed him to punish me because I'm rotten. Well, screw you, God. You'll get me in hell, but you won't get me before then. And I never refused to listen to any talk about God or anything like it from then on. And I told my sponsor that. He said, you're pretty sure that God hates you? And I said, yes. He said, I got some bad news for you. You're not important enough for God to hate. I wanted to say, yes, I am, but I was too shy. But he said to me, can you not understand in the steps, nothing in AA asks you to return to God? I said, oh, to a power greater than myself, Bob? Is that supposed to fool me? He said, it doesn't say that. I'll go read the book, number 2 over there on the wall. It says, came to believe that a power greater than myself would restore me to sanity. I know that. He said, can't you believe in a loving power greater than yourself? I said, no. He said, can't you believe that in AA, perhaps? I said, no. He said, do you think I'm doing better than you are? I said, of course you are. He said, congratulations. I'm your new higher power. And I could accept that because he's trying to help me. And he did help me. And he had me do things. And little by little, the mystery of AA is not that you get better. I never haven't gotten any better yet. But the world gradually shapes up around you, so it's easier living. And he had me do things. I remember among the greatest things that I tried was, he said, why don't you tonight just thank God for being sober? I went to bed that night and I thanked God for being sober. And I didn't feel any better. But I've done it ever since now for 50-some years and have a different approach to God, I guess. But one of the great things he did for me was had me make amends, because nobody wants to make amends to people that have been screwing you for 10 years. How about screwing them for a while? So I went, he said, I want you to go back to Dallas where you took the company truck and crashed it up drunk. And I went down, saved my pennies, and took a plane down there. I went and saw Doug. I said, Doug, I just came down here to tell you that I'm in AA now. And I'm sorry I wrecked your truck. Well, you should be sorry. That's the only truck we had. I said, I know, but I'm trying to do better, trying to find a new life. He said, what are you doing in AA? I said, because I believe I'm an alcoholic. What did you think was wrong with me? He said, I thought you were an asshole then. I think you're an asshole now. Get out of my office. I was so glad I'd saved those pennies for that. But then he said, I want you to go back to University of Wisconsin, where you got expelled for screwing a girl in the trophy room. And apologized to her, apologized to the school. And I went back there, when I went back to visit my folks, and I went to say, I'd like to speak, he was now the chief executive of the university. I said, I'd like to see Mr. Haas. And I heard him say, tell him I'm not here. I thought, well, So the next year I came back there again. I said, tell him I'm not here. Heard again, but I came back again. And he said, all right, send him in, I'll get rid of him. I said, Chancellor Haas, I want to come back and tell you how sad I am. I'm sorry that I behaved the way I did. He said, you do, you should have, because I covered for you and almost cost me my job. And I said, I'm so sorry. But I'm trying to find a new life in AA. I recently took out a different job. I became somewhat successful in advertising and public relations in Dallas, in Los Angeles. And through a series of strange phenomena, when I was about 15 years sober, I said to my new sponsor, I don't know why I don't feel very comfortable exactly. He said, I think I know why. I've never known anyone that's gone down quicker, faster, lower than you did, and come back faster and quicker and higher. He said, I don't think you're feeling worthy of it. I said, oh, yes, I am. But it turned out through a series of strange things, somebody called me and said, the director of the Midnight Mission, that damn place that threw me out, has just died after 40 years on the job. Do you know anybody who wants to take the job? They don't pay much, and they have to have some affinity for the men on the street, and they have to have some business sense. And I talked to about 50 people. I said, nobody wants to do that crappy job. But I was lying in bed one morning, and I said, well, it'd be kind of fun to go down there and do it for a couple of weeks. Because when they threw me out, I said, I'll be back. They won't remember it, but I remember it. And I went down and said, I'll do it for a couple of weeks till you find someone. They said, okay. So I got involved with my desk, and God, I really loved it. I was getting a little weary. Anyway, 15 years sober, I was tired of ungrateful newcomers. And here's a whole street full of dying men and women and trying to find ways to help them. And I got caught up in it. God, I felt young and alive again. And I said to my wife, I think I'll apply for the job. She said, we won't make much money. I said, no, go from 100,000 to 10,000, not much, kind of a jump. But I feel alive. And so I went down and applied for the job. And I started work there on February 1st, 1974. And I've been there ever since. Jesus. So when I get back to Los Angeles tomorrow, I have to go to Skid Row. You guys don't. But anyway, I said to the chancellor, I said, I'm sorry. And I went back to Los Angeles. And about a month later, I got a call from his secretary. She said, this is the chancellor's secretary. He knows that you and he don't get along very well, but maybe for old time's sake, you could help us. We were supposed to have an alumni luncheon in Los Angeles next week, and the man who's supposed to be in charge turns out is dead, and there's been not a plan made, and people are coming from all over. Could you help us find a place? I said, I'll call you back. And I called her back in a couple hours. I said, how about the Coconut Grove, where the movie star go every day, and you'll be there on Sunday afternoon being slick and slick and cute. She said, oh, really? I said, yes. I didn't tell her that I sponsored the manager. That's how I got him in there. And I said, there's one requirement, however. I must be invited. She said, but you're not an alumnus. I said, I know it. That's what makes it so wonderful. She said, I'll call you back. And she called me back and said, okay, the chancellor says you're welcome to come. And that day, he and I had coffee in that ornate Coconut Grove, and he said, what's this I hear about you giving up your big career to run down-and-out people, to help down-and-out people? I said, yeah, that's true in a way, I guess. He says, that's odd. You are the most selfish, one-way son of a bitch I've ever known. I can't believe you do anything for anybody without having some accrued pleasures from it. I said, no, it's hard to explain. He said, I'd like to see this place. I said, okay. He said, but I want you to call and let them know we're coming. I want to see it in all its pristine purity. So we drove over there, and of course, Sunday afternoon, pretty well cleaned up, guys on the street. Hi, Mr. Clancy. We went into my room, my office, and had some awards I've got. He says, I can't believe this. I can't. This is the greatest miracle since Christ turned water into wine. He said, I can't believe this. I said, well, that's the way it is. So he went home, and that was the end of it. Then I'm almost done. He's got a big ending on this one. I got a call in February from his secretary again. She said, do you know the chancellor's retiring in July? Or June at commencement? I said, no, I didn't know that. Wish him well. She said, but you know something odd? He has named you Distinguished Alumnus of the Year. Can you speak at commencement? And I said, you bet your ass I can, baby. So I went back and spoke at commencement and took all my kids back with me. My mother and father were both still alive. They cried. It was wonderful. And that was the end of it. But then I got back to Los Angeles. I can't let well enough alone. Goodbye. I'm not leaving. Let me fix the mic here. I got back. And I sent a little note to the university saying, but I'm not even an alumnus. How dare you name me your alumnus of the year? You expelled me. They sent me back some cockamamie reason. I did that every year. Aren't you sorry that you don't have an alumnus in Los Angeles? I could be something. And cute little things. And finally, one day the package comes, and then there's my diploma. And I'm now a graduate of the University of Wisconsin. If you ever come in my office in Los Angeles, you'll see the incongruous things. Alumnus of the year, 1980. Graduate, 1987. What I sometimes tell people about that is the miracle of Alcoholics Anonymous. I have not become a wonderful person. I hear people sometimes talk who have been sober a long time, and you're just waiting for God to come down and shake hands with them. I'm still emotional, and I'm still not as nice as I should be sometimes. But two things I have. Every night when I go to sleep, I thank God for my sobriety, and I ask him for knowledge of his will for me and the power to carry it out. I think that's the whole purpose of AA. And I go back over my day. Is there anybody here I should fix up? Because I think that's what we are here for, to see what God's will is for us and to do is what makes him feel good. I saw a TV special recently that showed all the thousands of planets and galaxies and everything whizzing just right. And you think, it's embarrassing sometimes to think you ask God to give all that up to find me a parking spot. But AA is about is living at peace any way you can. If you have to swallow your pride, it's a tough one. I did it, and I'm so glad I did. I'm glad that I'm safe and sane and sober. And I was talking in New Jersey the other night, and I was telling him, I hate corniness. I hate corny things. Especially in watching a Christmas story, the little kid in crutches always pointing in the last act. But he says something that I believe is so true in this meeting. He says, God bless us, everyone. Thank you. Yeah.